This is a Southern Historian podcast, and I'm Sarah Craddock. In this segment for our Careers for Historians series, I would like to share an interview I had in January 2017 with Southern environmental historian Bart Elmore. Dr. Elmore is the author of Citizen Coke, The Making of Coca-Cola Capitalism, and an editor for West Virginia University Press's new series, Histories of Capitalism and the Environment. In this interview with Dr. Elmore, he touches on important academic career issues graduate students face. Here's that interview.
I guess I wanted to start because with graduate school stuff, you are a tremendously successful historian, which is unusual for, you know, most graduate students to actually make it to the level you are now. So I kind of want to ask you about your humble beginnings as a graduate student, since this is a graduate journal.
Well, that is very kind for you to say, but I would say that honestly, I still am kind of humbled by it all, right? I mean, I think that the idea that this is a meritocracy and that somehow it was just by sheer awesomeness that these things kind of worked out, I think that's just not fair to the system. Unfortunately, I think we're kind of in a broken system in some ways. So many folks, you know, really talented PhDs looking for jobs. And, you know, when it comes to the job, which I think is the tenure track job, I think that's kind of the gold standard, but certainly kind of the El Dorado that we're all seeking when we go into grad school. I have to say that, you know, the process of who gets elected for that and who doesn't, you know, can swing on, you know, a few personalities in a department and, you know, a few people that may or may not like your work, or folks who really do like it, you know, and it also comes down to fit. You know, a lot of the universities are looking for something really, really specific. And so that's just the lead to say that I realize that there is a lot of chance involved in all this. And you can do as much as you can to put yourself in a good position. But ultimately, when you don't get that job or that fellowship, which trust me, I haven't gotten those things as well, you just get numb to failure. I think you really have to shrug it off and realize that it really, when people say it's not you, it's really true, right? I think I've had a lot more failures than I've had successes, I think, in this long run. And that's surprising, right? I mean, I think that's what I think about. I think about all the times I didn't get stuff, right? And so, I guess just my word of advice I always say is that, you know, you just have to be completely numb to failure and realize that that's the norm, actually. And it's the rare moments when things go right that you're like, wow, this is great. But those times pass, you know, and you get right back to it. So you got to love what you do. I think if I didn't love environmental history, the amount of times that a review has come back or I haven't gotten a journal article accepted or a fellowship or a job work out, I would have turned away from it. But I really do deeply think this is something that at my core I was meant to do. So that's what I'd say. I'll pause there. Maybe you could prod me a little bit on that. But I think that's important to get on the table for sure as you think about these things.
Absolutely. One thing I did want to touch on was just, I guess, how did you come to get involved in environmental history? Did you start out with that, or did it something you kind of discovered as you were already in grad school? How did that happen?
Right. And so kind of getting to, okay, so, all right, so that's true, Bart. Thank you very much. It's complicated and hard. That's not very helpful, right? So I think the next thing says, okay, well, what can you do? You know, what can you do to put yourself in a good position? And to answer your question, I think part of it is seeking out really good mentors. I think as a graduate student, and you're probably finding this, right, there are faculty that are more or less involved in the graduate program. And I think if you can find somebody that's really hands-on, that's offering, you know, advice on how to submit a letter to the editor of a newspaper or how to submit a book proposal, you really got to seek that out. And so in my case, I found an individual like this named Ed Russell, who was an environmental history hire at the University of Virginia. And I mean, he would do all sorts of stuff for us. We had workshops outside of the classes that we took with him where he would watch us speak. He would talk about how we held our hands. He would talk about kind of our nervous tics and things like that and help us to feel more comfortable as a lecturer and as a person speaking, he would walk us through the process of how you submit a book to a journal and how you submit it to an editor. We'd actually talk to book editors and things like that. So for me, finding Ed Russell my second year of graduate school, I was just drawn to him. I didn't know about environmental history at the time, and I was an environmentalist. So when I found that, for me, it was kind of like, wow, I'm combining these two passions that I have for history and environment. But also, more importantly, it was the mentor that was teaching the class that I was really, really drawn to as well. And I think having someone like him is invaluable and shaped my career in ways that I can't even begin to kind of break it down, how many ways he helped me get jobs and things like that. For example, and just one little note, when I gave my job talks, I don't read from notes. And when I go to conferences, I don't read papers. He was very much a proponent of us learning how to engage audiences by going and talking to them. So if there's one big thing I would say, finding a mentor that trains you in that way, trains you not just to be a good researcher, but hones your skills as a speaker, hones your skills as a professional, who understands the task that you're going to have to go through as a historian. So for me, that was my second year of graduate school. Man, I was lucky to find this guy.
Well, could you also tell us maybe how you found your dissertation topic?
So good news there for those who, come to graduate school without a clear vision. That was very much me as well. When I first got to Virginia, I started writing about Southern public school teachers. So that should give everyone hope, right? I mean, completely different topic than what I ended up writing about. I'd been a public school teacher in the South, and I wanted to write about the history of how our public schools got so bad. Really was basically the kind of the point. So I wrote a master's thesis my first year on Freedmen School teachers in Georgia and the South. And so Koch started in my second year. I started thinking, actually more, to be honest with you, more towards my third year of graduate school. I knew that I wanted to become an environmental historian. And actually, I tried my hack the second year at another dissertation topic that would fuse environmental and Southern history. So one of the dilemmas I had was that I had come to work with a Southern historian named Ed Ayers. And I had now found this new mentor named Ed Russell, who I also liked, my two Eds. And I think one of the dilemmas we have as graduate students is you want to have both, you want to have these great mentors in your camp. And so I really tried to think about, okay, well, what can I do in Southern environmental history? Really my two now passions. And at first I actually thought about writing about Southern rock and roll, writing an environmental history. I mean, this was such a pipe dream. Of Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Allman Brothers, and thinking about their music and their lives and how the environment was both reflective and influencing their music. After all, I mean, we call it Southern rock. I mean, why is it Southern rock? I mean, the only thing that really unites Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Allman Brothers, besides a certain stylistic sound, is that they're from the South, right? So anyway, that was a dumb idea. That did not pan out because, I don't think it was a good topic. And so I started kind of thinking about what I want to do. And I wanted to be engaged in doing history that was actually going to affect real policy and change. People might call me a presentist or an activist scholar. I really don't mind that. I did care about issues that were going on in our own time, and I wanted to kind of be engaged with that through history. So the point was I got to do a Southern topic. So I looked around and I think we thought about cotton, tobacco. You're like, okay, I'm going to do like these iconic Southern things. And then one day I think we saw a Coke can on either Grace Hale's desk or Eddie. I can't remember where it was, but, and I remember us kind of talking about Coke. Yeah, that's a Southern product that changed the world. And so it was really then, I think, kind of going into that third year that things kind of clicked. And the pace from that point was really fast. I mean, so then I basically finished the dissertation 2016. So really 3 years later, 3.5 years later, the thing was done. So is that right? I mean, that just seems so crazy, actually, to think about. But I think once you find it, once you know what it is and you've got the passion, you're like, that's a great topic. Things kind of flow a little bit faster. And that's what happened with me.
Well, it worked out really well.
It did. I mean, I think, again, like, what are the things that I got lucky with or that I didn't realize at the time? Picking a topic with a brand that is already marketing and advertising itself, you're kind of hitching yourself to that marketing pitch, you know, that's just constantly out there. I didn't realize how many people, this kind of sounds dumb, but, you know, like, everyone has a connection to Coca-Cola, right? And so the book, I think, did, and the dissertation did well because people just wanted to talk about their own personal relationship with the product they knew and understood. So I don't think everyone should do a product like that, but I have to say that picking a product that had that kind of brand strength, I was kind of piggybacking on their marketing, weirdly, despite the fact that I was trying to point out that the company was doing all these problematic things for the environment. I was benefiting from their marketing in some ways.
Right. Well, you know, and one thing I wanted to touch on here was, and you already touched on this somewhat, about, you know, having a great mentor making such a big difference. I know that when you were at University of Alabama, you had, I think, an undergraduate class where you guys did, you were actually hands-on going out and taking water samples and air samples and stuff. And could you talk about that maybe and how you think environmental historians should be part of making a public record?
Yeah, when I think about kind of the training of the next generation of scholars, one of the things I'd point out is that, you know, funding at universities is being cut all the time, especially in a new presidential era where who knows what the future will be. And it strikes me that we have to make some pretty strong cases as scholars, unfortunately, about, you know, why it is. Well, what are we really giving back to the community? After all, we're being vested with all this public funds and all of this. I think historians talking to one another, we know that, you know, it's obvious. We do history, and that's what's important. We are, by our very nature, chronicling the past, and in that way, preserving knowledge for the future, for future generations. However, I think, you know, when you think about what you're going to do as a teacher coming up as a grad student, finding ways to engage in the real world through your scholarship, I think, is really smart. It helps sell yourself on the job market in many ways, but also, I think, honestly, helps sell the field of history to people who think it's, you know, just a bunch of people sitting around in archives and not engaging in the real world. So for me, yeah, it was really important to get involved through my students and to think about the energy that's there. You have 30 to 40 students in a seminar that are just sitting there waiting to do something really profound that changes the world. And so one of the things I noticed as an environmental scholar is that, you know, in recent years, the EPA is really, despite what I think a lot of people in certain political persuasions would argue, the EPA is really innervated. It doesn't have the funding and the staff to deal with all the chemicals and pollution that goes on in the world. And so it struck me as a really smart idea to think about how can we turn universities into the watchdogs of environmental change in the United States? How can we take the student energy in our classrooms and go out and do the monitoring and chronicling of history that's not being done by agencies that are underfunded and don't have the personnel to do that? And so that's what I basically did, piloted this with my class, which was we went out and you say, well, wait a minute, this isn't history. You were taking air samples around businesses and that we knew were polluting and testing water around businesses that we knew were polluting. That sounds like science. But I'd argue that one of the jobs of historians is to chronicle history, right? And especially chronicle history that no one else is doing because we don't have the funds to be monitoring this stuff via some of our agencies. So we were making history. That's what I was, you know, saying to the class. And, you know, I think we're going to try this here now that I've moved to Ohio State in Columbus and try and model this for other universities. How can you turn classrooms into, again, these echo watchdogs where we're chronicling data so that we can see that change over time? If we don't have that data 10 years, 20 years from now, we're not going to be able to understand, well, what was the baseline and where are we at now? And I think historians are so good at telling narratives and telling stories that it's really incumbent upon us when we see these gaps in monitoring to be a part of telling the story so that we make change happen. Again, other folks would say this is just a total diversion from what we should do as historians, and that's totally fine to have that opinion. But for me, I think it's something that I'm really passionate about and was really glad to launch at the University of Alabama.
I think it's a great idea. And I was very inspired by it. Actually, I started working with the Alabama Water Watch, and I monitor one spot on one of the rivers down here in Mobile. So, yeah, it's been fun. It's been fun. It's my one science-y thing I do.
That's right. And I think that's a great point. I think we're, you're super smart and you should feel that way. I mean, I think that we sometimes shy away from doing those things that we think are not in our field. And I think the great thing about history is that, there's no boundaries, especially in environmental history. You're encouraged to become an amateur scientist, right? And to get out there and to get your hands wet. So I think it's beautiful when we do this and expand. By the way, the Alabama Water Watch site that I started on the Black Warrior River, right there in front of another broken egg on the river, is currently not being monitored after I left. So if you or you know of someone at the university who wants to keep that going, the information's all there. Everything's, the data points would just be filling in the gaps. So I'm happy to pass that off to someone who wants to do it.
Well, I'll have to look into it and see what I can do since I don't actually live in Tuscaloosa anymore. But there are others that might be willing to do that. So yeah. I'll see what I can do. Talking to some people. I guess another thing I wanted to talk to you about was, the future of the field, right? Especially considering, I think the current, not only the physical climate, but the political climate. And what do you think that, how do you think that is going to affect the future of the, the history?
Right. So I would just reiterate what I just said about kind of teaching. I think one of the things that it's even more important to do is to think about how we as environmental historians can be a part of chronicling the story of what's happening. Again, yes, we deal with the past, but we also are storytellers, and we have the kind of skills and acumen of being good writers, or we should, right, on our good days. And so I think using those skills to make sure that the misinformation that may come from certain circles doesn't, hold sway, I think is really important. And so doing classes like the class we were just talking about, I think, would be a really great thing if we could see other institutions doing that as well in environmental history. I think also what I would say is that I'm actually sanguine about the future of environmental history in the new political era. In part because I can look to history and see hope. When you think about Reagan coming into office in, the 80s, in 1981, we realize that, yes, he appoints Ann Gorsuch, and we see kind of this environmental disaster. He's gutting the EPA and, some things that are akin to what we're seeing today. And what that did was actually inspire massive memberships in environmental organizations. It also inspired a more radical environmental movement in Earth First and other radical environmental groups. And so sometimes what we see from history is actually when the reins are handed over to those who would tell us that ecology doesn't matter and that we can just burn fossil fuels nonstop, we see the birth of a larger resistance movement. So I wholly expect that if policies under the Trump presidency are carried out, there are going to be some really serious problems that are going to push people to want to get involved. And hopefully that includes people wanting to become environmental historians. I think the future of the field, to your point, is always uncertain. It's, you know, we as historians never want to predict the future, but I can see trends. I would say that if we went back to the beginning of environmental history, Donald Worster and the founders of the field, you know, they were very much engaged, right, in the real world. I mean, Donald Worster, again, one of the founders of environmental history, in his book Dust Bowl, calls out capitalism as, you know, he doesn't mince words, as, you know, an economic way of thinking about the world in which has profound implications for an environment. And I just don't think he shied away from being provocative in that sense. I think we went through a phase in the 1990s, especially, where we wanted to be more nuanced. And that's great. We wanted to be a little bit more, okay, well, wait a minute. There is no such thing as a pure wilderness. You know, humans have always been affecting nature. We can't weigh in necessarily on good or bad environmental impacts. I mean, that's reducing this considerably, the debate that was going on in the field. But we just became kind of relativist about all this, right? I think we're moving back. I think of myself as part of a new generation of scholars who are really saying, well, wait a minute, let's go back to first principles. Yes, we know that ecosystems do not tend towards equilibrium. We know that nature is a constructed term, and yes, the boundaries between the man-made world and nature are inherently, you know, fluid. But at the same time, we also know from history that nature, that natural systems have done a really good job of sustaining life on this planet for a very long time. And it strikes me that there's something to be learned from that. And so kind of getting back to, yes, okay, we know things are complex, but there are real environmental problems that are going on in the real world, and we've got to do something about chronicling the history that helps us figure out how to get around those issues in the future. So in some ways, I feel like we're like the future for me is actually kind of going back to where the field began, you know, several decades ago, back in the 1970s. And that's exciting to me. And one of the reasons I love being in this family of environmental historians.
Well, more specifically to, I guess, Southern history, since this is a Southern Historian Journal. Is there anything particular or special, I guess, about Southern environmental history that really sets it apart, or should it be viewed more as part of a whole?
I love your question, Sarah. This is perfect. I mean, I think there is something to be said about the future of Southern environmental history. I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface there. Yes, we have had some amazing works coming out really since the 1990s in Southern environmental history, which is a really young field if you think about that. I mean, maybe, you know, if you're being generous, 2 decades really of